Hey, comrades, this is Patrick Barney coming at you with another podcast from your three buddies, including me and Hans Berger and Chris Malmberg. As we announced last week, or not, excuse me, not last week, last podcast, we're making some changes. We're no longer going to be going under the title The God Setebos. We're going to go under the title of Book Spider, which I think is a pretty cool name. And all of this kind of came about because the press that the podcast was associated with is going under. We're not going to be continuing on with that side of the endeavor. So that's what the change in the name is for, to kind of just start a new course, start a new chapter. Luckily, though, for longtime listeners, nothing is really going to change about the content of this podcast. It's still going to be about books, and we're all three of us pride ourselves on doing differentiating our podcast by being a little more critical, a little more analytic, a little less casual than maybe some of the other book podcasts out there. With that being said, today we're going to discuss Philip K. Dick's A Scanner Darkly, which is a really fantastic novel. I like because having had problems with drug addiction in the past, it's a really empathetic look at drug users and drug abuse and the negative effects of chronic drug use. And really, what I find super wonderful and fascinating about the novel is how well it captures just the detached or paranoiac or otherworldly mindset you get when you're on drugs all the time. You like it's not quite the same as the novel in that you know what's real and what's not, but your thinking gets distorted in ways that's really hard to explain. So that's one of the reasons that I really dig this novel. So I'm gonna start with that. What do you guys think this novel is trying to say about drug use and drug abuse in portraying? Oh wait, I forgot to summarize. That's right. So hold on to that question. That's right, because we need to have the summary of the novel. So I'm gonna wing it here because I forgot about that part. But this novel is about a guy named Bob Arctor, who is both a user of an illicit drug called Substance D and a member of the police department. And in his role as a member of the police department, he is set he is tasked with spying on basically all of the drug users in his social group. And it becomes complicated because Substance D has this effect that I'm not sure if we want to call it a split personality effect. I don't really like that, but basically there's a explanation in the novel where the drug causes two identities to form in the user, based on the two different hemispheres of the brain. So, Arctor's personal, like the self or identity known as Arctor, splits off from the other self, known as Fred, the other identity. And this is the name that he is known by in the police department. And the reason why he's not known as Bob Arctor in the police department is because he's wearing what's called a scramble suit, basically a suit that disguises what the wearer looks like by constantly shifting patterns of different facial features and body types. So as the novel progresses, Arctor begins to kind of like these two identities that are both in Arctor, Fred and Bob, split off from one another, and they're not really able to understand that they're part of the same identity or the same person. And so that's the main idea of the novel, but mostly the novel is just, you know, drug users sitting around talking about weird stuff. And there are some big reveals at the end, which will probably, you know, get mentioned in the course of the novel. So that's the summary. Let me go back to the question. What do we think this novel is trying to say about drug abuse and drug use?
It's interesting. You know, you mentioned that it's an empathetic perspective on drug addiction, right? Which I would certainly agree with. But it's also interesting mm-hmm. because it, at some point in the novel, and I should have highlighted this. I should have had this passage handy. So, you know, if you guys can figure out what I'm talking about here, you can jump in with a quote. But he actually says at one point that it's a mistake to think of drug addiction as a disease, right? And I think that's an interesting passage, and I think that's actually the end note
afterward.
The afterword from Dick, yeah.
Right.
And that's an interesting way to frame it, because almost all empathetic discussion of drug addiction now is premised on the assumption that it is a disease, right?
Right.
The disease model, it's like you have a choice between the disease model and the choice model. Either this is a disease or it's a conscious choice. And, you know, the perspective of disease is associated with empathy, and the perspective of choice is associated with a punitive model. And so it's interesting, I think, first of all, that he frames it, in fact, as a choice, right? Although he mm-hmm. says, you know, it's a choice that people underwent. It's a choice that people went into wanting a good time, not understanding the ramifications of what they were doing. And you know, they've suffered for that lack of understanding. So, I mean, I think part of what it might say kind of is just about there's a level of naivety maybe that it describes to people in the drug culture that a lot of people in it had kind of that they had gotten into it, even if that they did in fact come into it as a matter of choice, but without really understanding the nature of it, right? And I think it does a pretty good job actually of capturing what is appealing about the lifestyle of, you know, being somebody who spends most of your time hanging out with your friends getting wasted, right? You mentioned that a lot of the novel is just guys sitting around being stoned, shooting the shit, right? And it is actually, like, surprisingly, even though it certainly is, you know, it's completely unflinching about showing squalor and poverty and violence all kind of connected to the larger drug trade, it also is, I think, really, really faithful in the way that it portrays that particular kind of camaraderie, closeness, friendship among, you know, wastoids, right? Like, but that's not a Dick term, but it's interesting, you know, when people talk about Philip K. Dick, most of the praise tends to come down to his kind of conceptual ability, right? He's regarded as a very good creator of concepts and ideas. But I mean, as somebody who's been a really big Philip K. Dick fan for, you know, decades, most of what I find appealing about it is much less the kind of conceptual stuff and more just the day-to-day texture of the people and the kind of the people and the worlds, meaning world at the level of like a house, right? Like, there's a particular kind of texture of how his characters talk and behave and hang out and think and you know, express themselves. And there's something about that texture that I've always found very appealing. And this is the way, I mean, this is very good at capturing that texture, you know? So I think that it's clear, I think, about both the appeal and the horrors of being immersed in kind of the day-to-day world of heavy drug use.
Yeah, you said naivete of those who choose choose this lifestyle, and maybe the choice is not entirely conscious of ramifications or what it means for your health, for the people around you. But something in what you said about naivete, you know, and how the novel portrays drug users in kind of two lights, because Fred, the police half of our protagonist, gives a presentation to a community as a policeman infiltrating the drug community. And it's very clear that people see the drug community as kind of a, you know, it's simultaneously full of victims and victimizers. And when you said naivete, Hans, it kind of makes me wonder if we see a lot of victimizers in the drug community, actually, or do we see more people who are maybe not even necessarily victims, but they're certainly not not all of them, not even most of them are the monsters that that community sort of that maybe the general public, the straights, maybe expect them to be. And that's a kind of like a delicate, you know, nuanced, I think, take on that sort of, I would think at the time that the book came out, I think that we've had more sort of stories told, more artifacts in art and culture that explore sort of the sad, melancholic, silly, stupid aspects of being a wastoid, that sort of juxtapose against this very dark, menacing portrayal that that is, I think, maybe exemplified in sort of like the war on drugs, right? It's like a war because they're on one side and we're on the other. We are the good ones and they're the bad guys. And I don't think that this, this novel, it doesn't necessarily like, it's interesting, like Patrick, you asked this question because, you know, reading this novel, I think there's like a kind of an interesting sort of chain of culpability for the drug problem, in that ultimately when we find out where substance D is coming from, what that means, right? And what that means for this community of drug users who may have chosen this life, but are they choosing to stay there, or are they just kept there for fear of many of them bring up the terror of including Bob Arctor, the terror of withdrawal. So it's kind of a trap. And then where the drugs are coming from and how that, you know, sort of implicates, I guess, like a larger system.
Right.
Does that, Patrick, kind of get at, because I think that you can't talk about like the one without the other.
That makes sense to me. And I was, when you get to the ending and you realize that basically Arctor has been a patsy's not quite the right word, but you know, the police department has been using Arctor. The whole plan is to get his brain to be totally mush from Substance D and to make him unable to really be able to think or understand or remember anything, so that he will then infiltrate New Path, which is ostensibly a rehabilitation center. They want him to infiltrate New Path and to discover the source of Substance D, and hopefully the police's hope is that through like pattern recognition and the unconscious, he will pull out some piece of evidence that New Path is manufacturing Substance D, which is what happens. It's indicated at the end of the novel that he is picking up this black or deep blue flower that is the source of Substance D that New Path is growing and harvesting. So I definitely think that's related to this question of what the novel is saying about abuse. It certainly seems to indicate to my mind that the novel is pointing a finger at, like, if we're going to blame addicts for their problems and their choices, well, we also have to blame the greater forces that make these drugs available to them. Like, we can't just blame drug offenders. We also have to blame, the manufacturers of drugs and the people who are profiting off drugs. So I think that's definitely a good connection between the ending of the novel and this question about what it's saying about drug use. And I think like that, despite the afterword where Dick says, you know, drug use is not a disease, it's a choice. Otherwise, otherwise the picture that he portrays here in A Scanner Darkly is very similar to like what I would say the more advanced understanding of drug use is that we have today. You know, that it's very similar to a disease, if not a disease. And there's plenty of mitigating factors that make drug abuse not necessarily the moral responsibility of the drug user.
What do you think it is that New Path wants? Because, I mean, in the world of the novel, right, New Path, the rehab company, is creating this very addictive drug, selling it, and then, you know, people come in and go through rehab. I guess the obvious, if it were anybody else writing the novel, the answer would be money, right? It's a great big money-making
right.
scheme. But I think it's, man, the last, like, 15 or 20% of this novel, You know, like the thoughts and conversations that happen once he's in the New Path facility are, there's something there that I didn't quite crack open, or something there that I didn't feel sure about the way that I felt sure about what I was getting out of most of the rest of the novel, right? And the easy answer is, you know, New Path is capitalism and they're just, you know, squeezing money out of people through this cycle. But there's a suggestion at the end that there's more than that, right? That it's almost kind of like a utopian project almost. Am I understanding that right?
Where'd you get that? I mean, I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just wondering what made you think that.
Boy, I wish I had a hard copy. I wish I had a hard copy of the novel, right? I wish that I had it in front of me that I could pick up and flip through. There were things that were said during the New Path, either thoughts that were had or things that were said during the New Path sequence. I don't know. I was hoping somebody else had retained it a little bit better and could jump on that, right? But maybe they didn't. So it might be something that maybe, like, you know, I have to kind of poke around and maybe come back to later in the podcast if I can find in my digital copy here.
There's an aspect of New Path that feels compelling and challenging because of the game that they play, the game where it seems they take turns being the target of incredibly vicious verbal abuse from the others who are committed there, and the doctors as well. And then actually, like, that's actually kind of interlaced with some, I think it seems, genuine, if perfunctory, desire to see the people there improve on behalf of the, you know, the staff and doctors and community among the people who are there too. Like, it's not actually, this isn't One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, even if the game feels horrific at one point. What is Bob Arctor's name when is it Bruce? He goes by Bruce.
Yeah.
Bruce, formerly Bob Arctor and Fred, whose brain is mush, is getting verbally abused by many people, including an Asian woman. And then later the Asian woman is I think decently kind to him. And there is this kind of it's a complicated portrayal of a facility that, you know, is not like being simply portrayed as something that's taking advantage of the people who are there, even if the treatments that it's employing feel sometimes kind of grotesque and wrong. So I don't know if I got that it was an ideological conspiracy of some sort, but it seemed to be a more complicated thing, like just getting the very edge of something larger and not really being able to judge that thing entirely, because you know, if it simply was a kind of a giant machine for developing brain dead workers to mine the poison that makes people brain dead to begin with, you would think that the New Path medical facilities would be a kind of an afterthought, but they didn't feel that way to me. It really kind of felt almost maybe like journalistic, or, you know, in terms of just kind of capturing what something like that might feel like. There's the, oh, go ahead.
I mean, some of what you're describing, like the game, right? The kind of rituals of abuse. Is that a cult tactic? Like breaking people down through that kind of group ritual abuse? That's like a cult initiation tactic, right? I mean, that's, I guess, and it's interesting that you read that sequence and got some amount of legitimate, the sense of maybe like a somewhat legitimate therapeutic practice out of it. And, you know, to some extent, I guess, A, this was written, you know, probably like a lot of understandings of therapeutic practice have changed since this was written, and B, like none of us are experts either in cults or therapeutic practice, right? But like at the time that I read this, I was also reading the novel The Incendiaries by Aro Kwan, which is, among other things, it has sequences that are set inside a cult, right? And the that some of the behaviors in New Path reminded me a bit of some of the ways that internal cult behavior functions in The Incendiaries. And that might be part of why I had the sense of New Path as something other than just, you know, a money-making operation, right? That there's some real attempt here to take... that there's some real attempt here to take, you know, I'm trying to think of a polite way to put it, that there's some real attempt here to take maybe people who are not functioning well in society and scoop them up and kind of very forcibly repress them into a different kind of person, right? That is a goal more so than financial benefit, or as much as financial benefit.
I'm going to remain neutral on this question because I'm just not sure. I think I would need to go back and reread the ending and think about it some more. But I think that there's at least the sense that there's not really a, like, it doesn't seem like New Path is totally denounced as evil. Even if it is, there seems to be some complication to it. And that makes me wonder what this novel is saying about the police, like police as a body of authority, because, you know, on the one hand, we've got interactions with police in this novel where, like some of the police, specifically the like psychologists that Arctor sees, they seem empathetic with his plight. But then at the end, you know, we come to understand that, like, they're using him to infiltrate New Path. So, like, if New Path is more complicated, if it's not just this monolithic evil, you know, representing capitalism or whatever, are the police also more of a complex kind of thing in the same manner, or are they just evil and, you know, we hate them? What do we think?
I think they're definitely complicated. The, you know, there's definitely a kind of an oppression occurring with police bullying Arctor and his friends for no reason other than that they look like losers and like drug addicts. And that is very pretty clearly portrayed as awful and pointless and not part of like the job. But also fundamentally, it's very interesting to me. I think that we've we've kind of grown up in a time, I guess like a post-Watergate evolved state where it's interesting when conspiracies don't kind of have some sort of like federal or like governmental like root stem, you know, like New Path is being legitimately investigated by an arm of the police.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually, you know, like it's not like, you know, maybe if there was a sequel, they'd find out that New Path is basically the child of some sort of like senator. And, you know, it has a lot of like, you know, federal ties or whatever like that. But ultimately their job, the thing that they're doing is a real job to kind of dig out this, this at least perceived, and I don't think the novel argues against this, toxic presence in communities. Bob Arctor himself and is at times kind of reflecting on the really terrible things that are happening, I guess, like in the margins around these sort of, you know, stoned conversations that he has with his friends. He is it Kimberly? He goes to check on a girl who, Kimberly or Amanda, who is living with a drug dealer. And that's harrowing. I mean, it's an awful thing that is happening. And so, you know, just as like the drug users in that community is not simply a monster, it's also not simply a big pool of victims either. There's a lot of darkness there. There's a lot of like bad health for people and bad outcomes. And the police are not simply the beat cops who are bullying the hippies with long hair whenever they find them. They're also these undercover agents who are trying to get into New Path and actually solve a real problem. So I think it's complicated.
I mean, fuck the police, but okay. And similarly, I'm interested in what the novel is like. How does the novel investigate surveillance and the use of surveillance? And while I was listening to this, I kept thinking of 1984 and how surveillance in that novel is just, it's not complicated, it's not complex, it's a form of control. You know, they are watching you, and you know they know. Even when you think they can't see you, they see you. And surveillance in this novel seems to be more complicated because it doesn't ever. You would think that Arctor being able to kind of look at all these tapes and see what is happening in the apartment when he's not there, you would think that would be illuminating for him, that it would be a way for him to understand the truth and what's really happening. But it doesn't seem to be. It doesn't like, there's this mystery about around this woman that he slept with, and like, you know, it's strange because First we get the experience of him like taking a woman home, and he like wakes up in the middle of the night and he sees her face, and it's just, you know, this random woman. But then he looks back at her and it's Donna, who is his crush. But then it reverts back. So we think, well, it was just a trick of the imagination. But then he goes back as as Arctur and watches the tapes that, you know, are surveilling his home, and the same thing happens. Like, it's this woman, and then it's Donna, and then it's this woman again. So what do we think of all this? What does this mean?
Well, it's interesting. I think surveillance is interesting in this novel because it, your comparison to 1984 is an interesting one, right? Because, like, in 1984, and you're a lot more familiar with 1984 than I am, but, right, like, the surveillance, like, part of the idea of surveillance is always for the people being surveilled to know they're being surveilled, right? Or like, the idea of surveillance is always complicated by the question of how much knowledge the surveilled have of what they're doing, of what's happening to them, right? So it's like,
right,
surveillance is partly useful as a you know, tool for recording and gathering information, and then it's also partly useful as a mechanism of social control. And I think what's interesting about the portrayal of surveillance in this novel is that the people who are being surveilled are, their concept of, they're correct to believe that they're being surveilled, but their concept of their experience is so warped by paranoia and delusion that surveillance almost becomes, I don't want to say unhelpful as a mechanism for social control, right? But it's like the people, the characters in the novel believe that they're being manipulated and controlled, but their vision of how they are being manipulated and controlled is so bizarre and different,
right,
from
right,
what they're actually experiencing, right? So there's like that kind of extended comic sequence where they go out for a drive, and they come back to the main core of drug users come back to the house, and they gradually, initially kind of in a comic way, but then gradually in a more serious way, kind of spin up this fantasy that drugs have been hidden throughout the house to set them up for an arrest. And you know, they're trying to figure out, like, what do we do about these drugs that are hidden all through the house, that they're going to, you know, they could break in at any time, or it could be years, or, you know, who knows what we do with, you know, this house full of drugs. And of course there is no house full of drugs, but in fact, you know, part of the goal of that trip, if I remember right, was to clear them out so surveillance technology could be installed. So it's like, there's an interesting effect where, I guess, surveillance is kind of like, if you think about those two mechanisms, right, information gathering and social control, or those two purposes, information gathering and social control, it doesn't work as a mechanism of social control because the people who are being surveilled are so bad at accurately construing reality that they almost don't need to be surveilled in a way, right? Like their own paranoia would probably do enough to, like, make them believe they were being surveilled. And it doesn't work as a mechanism for information gathering, I think partly because so much information is being gathered that the job of sorting through it to find relevant or meaningful or useful things kind of becomes overwhelming to the surveilling apparatus, right? Mm. Like, Arctur just sits, and or Arctur in his Fred persona is just, like, sitting and going through, you know, endless hours of recording, trying to find anything interesting while continuing hours of recording pop up. So, like, the surveillance, I think, has become so pervasive in this novel that it begins to erode its own usefulness through its own pervasiveness, right? You have such a wealth of information being gathered. I don't really know what to make of the sequence where the surveillance tape shows the woman's face changing, right? I've never quite known what to make of that. I guess either that's evidence that, I guess one way you could take that is that the persona of Fred is also kind of Fred's sanity and grasp of reality are eroded in ways that are connected to the eroding sanity of Bob Arctor? Mm-hmm. Or is there some kind of metaphysical quality to that scene, right? Where, like, I don't know if metaphysical is at all the right word for it, actually, but, you know, is it the kind of system, like the systems that are being used to surveil and control people are beginning to break down because of the pathologies of the people inside them, and that's like an kind of a literalization of that? I don't know. I don't know for sure what to make of that.
So we don't buy Fred's assumption that the tape has been tampered with in some way. This is a reflection of his distorted psyche, not, you know, some mechanical problem.
Well, if the tape were being tampered with, it would have to be tampered with by, like, if the tape were being tampered with, it would have to be tampered with by somebody who knew that Fred had had that particular hallucination in bed at that time, right?
Right.
And who knows, only one person knows that he had that hallucination. So it could be, I suppose, the only person who would be tampering with the tape to produce that effect would be Fred slash Bob, right?
Right.
But I guess it might be a manifestation of the kind of doubling or halving of his mind that he tampers with the tape and then forgets that he tampered with the tape.
Well, you talking about it reminded me. It didn't occur to me until you were sort of describing it over again, Hans. But what this makes me think of, and I was going to say that the surveillance aspects of this novel actually age pretty poorly for me. Not that it gets anything wrong, just that there's so much absent in terms of the proliferation of media. And now, like, our sort of the idea of surveillance is complicated these days by how much content is being developed by people on themselves, which I'm not sure what the word for that is. We're basically, you're engaging the rest of the world in surveillance of yourself because you're just portraying yourself, or you're broadcasting yourself all the time. But maybe I should rethink that, because the issue with the woman's face changing, what that reminds me of is police body cameras and how we have this idea in our society that's maybe reaching kind of like the end of its honeymoon phase, where having videos of things that happen will clear everything up, right? Like, that's the idea. Like, oh my God, all we need is a video that shows that this young black man was shot for no reason. And the reality is that those videos haven't solved that problem. The videos still end up portraying things that people see, like what they sort of were prepared to see anyway, right? That's kind of what happens, where it's like, well, he kind of reached for his waist there, and, like, you know, and you don't know, and all of this stuff. Like, there's no, the objective perspective of the video cannot escape the inescapable gravity of our subjective reality, right? Like, that's what we're stuck with. And that is very interesting to me with the video of that catches the woman's face changing, because it kind of reminds me, one of your other questions that you sent ahead of time, Patrick, was we're not really given a rundown of the symptoms of some, or symptoms, the the what substance D does to the user. And the thing is, we're stuck inside the user's head. And what that moment, I think, reminds me of is that we're stuck in the user's head. Like, even though we're getting, this is kind of meta, but even though we're reading about the video feed, we're reading about it through the perspective of a substance D user who is at this point experiencing some severe poor outcomes from brain damage. And he himself is not fooling anybody. Like, his own supervisor knows that he's Bob Arctor. And it kind of makes me wonder about, like, is he just sort of being surrounded by people who are just sort of playing along, you know, and allowing him to watch videos of himself and take notes?
Probably. The whole plan is to use him, right?
Yeah.
So everyone around him probably knows what's happening to him.
Maybe not everybody, but a
good deal.
And he's not. Where I find myself in the end is appreciating that I feel like, and it's definitely my own reading for the moment, that take on what surveillance is, which is actually just something that doesn't provide answers generally that contradict what we sort of already brought to the table in terms of expectations. That's surveillance reaffirms what we expect to find.
Well, sure. I mean, but that, of course, that's a problem of the human psyche and less a problem of, the actual technology. You know, surveillance shows us what happened and we just interpret it, right?
Yeah. And he saw the woman's face change. And
right,
the woman's,
sure.
And yeah. So the woman's face changed. And, like, just because it's a video of the woman, like, that doesn't mean that it's not going to change.
And I think that surveillance can be dangerous, too, not just because, I mean, connected to what you're saying about, like, distortions of the psyche, right? It's also easy, I think, to, you get a certain amount of something and you think you have the complete picture, right? And that is kind of a similar failing of surveillance. Partly that it reaffirms whatever perceptions we already have, and I think partly also that it can create the sense of a fullness of knowledge that we don't have.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So I don't know
if I have a good example of that connected to this novel, but
right.
I think we've all made interesting points about the kind of definition and function of surveillance.
Surveillance is like a, you know, the uptick of surveillance and the use of surveillance leads to all sorts of complications and problems. So let's shift gears here, and, you know, we probably only have time for one more in-depth question if we're gonna try to keep this at about an hour. So I would really like to talk about what we think about the movie, but you said you haven't read it, Chris, so maybe it would be better to talk about something that's less interpretive of the novel, like less thinking about what the novel is saying and doing, and maybe more about something that is problematic in Dick's work, which is his treatment of women, and, like, how does this novel stack up as far as that is concerned. Like, in some novels of Dick's, we get, you know, totally kind of not very well-developed female characters or not very interesting female characters. And then responding to criticism, which you told me, Hans, you know, Dick's final novel features a woman, and it you know, it's really a fantastic novel, and, you know, a good thing that, you know, for his final book, Dick was able to, like, take some of the feedback he'd gotten about his inability to portray women well and do a really fantastic novel with a great female character. But how do we think this novel stacks up?
Not nearly as badly as a lot of others, I would say off the top of my head. It might be that I could be talked out of that. I mean, I think that two thoughts that I had about the portrayal of women in this novel. I mean, the first is that there is a lot of kind of objectifying of women or mm-hmm. kind of, you know, sexualization, but a lot of that is coming from the perspectives of, you know, assholes, right?
Right, yeah.
There's that the way that women are talked about and thought about, generally, in the instances where it is despicable, it's coming from people who are pretty well established, either as despicable people or just as, you know, vacuous people, right? And if anything, it probably, there's a certain amount of casual, kind of casual objectification that it's, I don't know if it's critiquing, because it's maybe not an in-depth critique, but it's portraying in a critical way, right? Mm. Or in an unsympathetic way. And I think that Donna is a really interesting kind of mutation of what I understand to be a standard Philip K. Dick character type, right? Because, like, he's very, you know, like, one of the kind of recurring figures in his novels is the petite, beautiful, dark-haired woman who is in some way sinister or manipulative, right? Excuse me. And, I mean, Donna is a petite, beautiful, dark-haired woman who is in some sense intensely manipulative, but her manipulation is actually portrayed as being, A, toward a genuinely admirable end, and B, something that she feels intensely conflicted about, right? Mm. And Donna's really interesting because she seems, for most of the novel, like a relatively shallow character. And then when we flip to her perspective at the end, we come to a much deeper understanding of a lot of things that she was doing that,
right,
from a purely external perspective, seemed maybe reductive, or maybe like she was kind of an unsympathetic portrayal of a certain type of person. So, right. Yeah, I mean, off the top of my head, I would say that this actually does pretty well in relationship to its portrayal of women.
Right.
At least given the standards of the author and the time, you know.
Yeah, I mean, compared to his other work, I definitely, like, I think that's a great kind of description of how, like, at first, you know, Donna doesn't seem that deep of a character or that well-rounded of a character, but then we get her perspective and it's much, you know, she's much deeper and much more conflicted and much more human than at first we are led to believe.
And she has far more agency. I mean, she has,
yeah,
she has more agency than Bob Arctor. I mean,
right. Yeah.
She, I think, I don't know if this would be the right choice, but I feel like a workshop bit of feedback that I'd expect if PKD was shopping this in like a graduate program would be like, well, the story's really about her, right? Because she's actually, well, no, because she's the one who has
control. I hate
control.
That type of feedback.
Yeah. But I think that it's interesting when you begin to sort of like the cone of probability does not, in terms of like what is possible for Bob Arctor / Fred to be sort of aware of and capable of changing in his life is not favorable. Like his subjective reality is about he's perceiving more control than he likely has. And right. And if you kind of pitch off the cliff into like the more conspiratorial readings of like, this is all sort of structured around him. I don't know if it is. I think like the police department could just be taking advantage of the fact that he's losing his mind. And they're like, well, you know, he seems like a good candidate, but I'm not sure that that's true either. Just I didn't get it super clear that like Donna was setting him up this whole time, but he does not have the same amount of control over his life or the world around him as Donna.
Right.
And that's interesting. She has far more agency than our main character.
Mm-hmm. That is interesting. Okay.
I think the story should be about her. I'm gonna write PKD a letter.
Oh,
yeah.
You can't. He died.
I'll send it. I'll address it to heaven.
Oh, you poor, poor fool who still believes in heaven. You little boy. Anyway, okay. Good discussion. You know, super interesting novel. I'm not sure that, like, I don't actually feel like I understand it better, except maybe how the ending, like, fits in with everything. But, you know, for me, this novel is really about the experience of empathizing with these people who, despite what Dick says, are afflicted. You know, I think the common consensus is that addiction is a disease and that it needs to be treated like one. You know, at least these days, you can't fault him for living in a time where that discovery or that model hadn't been adopted. But I that's probably the main reason that I love this novel is how empathetic it is towards its characters. And having read other things by PKD was not something that I expected. Like, he is a very high concept writer, and a lot of the time the high concepts kind of do interfere with some of the empathy that you would expect out of a novel. Maybe another one that's not so bad on the empathy front is Ubik, which is really great book. Really enjoy it. That being said, what are we gonna talk about next time, Chris?
What are we pulling into the web?
Yeah, so reading Scanner Darkly made me want to reread Cosmopolis, and Hans, actually, before the podcast began, reminded me that though I haven't seen Scanner Darkly movie, I think that it's penetrated culture enough that I've seen clips and things, and I understand that it's a very, very faithful adaptation. Cosmopolis 2 is a very faithful adaptation. And they both
the film with Robert
the
Pattinson.
The film with Robert Pattinson.
Pattinson.
Yeah, and they both, as I understand it, track the dialogue very closely, and the dialogue of both Cosmopolis, maybe Scanner Darkly is more like internal rumination, but the dialogue of Cosmopolis is. Largely long sort of explorations of philosophical concepts and examinations that kind of, I think, mirror some of the longish set pieces in Scanner Darkly, where Arctur is sort of stoned and conjecturing about reality with his friends. And so there's a lot of similarities between the two. And actually, I'm curious, coming from Scanner Darkly to Cosmopolis, in maybe exploring the kind of edge of, the event horizon, or the ways in which the characters that were given in Cosmopolis may be incorrectly analyzing and describing their world. It's not maybe a reading that I've really taken to Cosmopolis before. It feels like we are with intelligent, if quirky and strange people who are making really sort of like broad, cutting judgments, broad but cutting judgments about like the state and future of commerce and what capitalism, the inevitability of capitalism and all of those things. But I feel like, because I'm just about done with Cosmopolis on the way through, this is my third time reading it, I think. There are some interesting ways to sort of read it and talk about maybe what these characters are not getting about their world.
Mm. Cool. Interesting. Yep. All Excellent. Right, listeners, you heard it. We're going to delve into Don DeLillo's Cosmopolis the next time that the three of us meet for the Book Spider podcast. Until then, peace out.